Welcome once again to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. My name is Peter Woodbury, and I'll be your host. Today we have the opportunity to speak with Freddy Silva. He's a specialist and researcher of sacred sites. He's a best-selling author. He's been doing some really interesting study and research with portals, and actually been in touch with NASA about these interesting sun connection spots that we have here on Earth. So without further ado, let's talk with Freddy and learn more about these subjects. Well, Freddy, nice to meet you, and thank you for joining us on this on the Edgar Cayce television show, Reflections. How are you
today?
Oh,
thanks for having me on,
Peter. Oh, it's a pleasure. So I understand you're in Portland, Maine, kind of dealing with the latest snowstorm that hit there.
Yeah, if you want to come and see what climate change looks like, you should come up to the Northeast or even in Britain, where it's really out of control. But yeah, we're still waiting for, spring. It looks like December right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that climate change, people thought it was just going to be everything getting hotter, but it seems like it's the worst of both worlds. We're getting, you know, more drastic winters, bigger storms, and hotter summers.
Yeah, I mean, people don't really understand this, least of all the guy that's trying to run the country, and that is that, climate change means that places that were dry are now wet, places that were wet are now dry, everything's literally going to be turning upside down, and we're in the middle of this cycle. And I mean, I am quite serious when I say that when you go to Britain, and I'm about to leave to do another one of my tours, the weather gets worse every year. I mean, mm-hmm. We're getting blizzards in the south of England. We don't get blizzards mm-hmm. in the south of England. And it's now become acceptable to have 60-mile-an-hour winds there. They don't even bat an eyelid now when the weatherman says, oh, this evening there'll be 60-mile-an-hour winds. That's just now a normal day in the British Isles.
Wow.
It's really bad. And when you think where the country is, it should technically be under ice because it's the same latitude as Labrador. The only thing that keeps it alive and habitable is the Gulf Stream, and that's obviously going south every year. I think it wants a vacation. So, we're living in very interesting times, as the Chinese say.
Yeah, definitely. So tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you, I know that you're well known for your interest in your research in sacred sites, but tell me a little bit about what got you there. What was your path?
Oh, a boredom and curiosity. It's a very dangerous combination. I was always fascinated by stuff like pyramids. I mean, I was drawing pyramids when I was three. I was never really accepting of the orthodox version of events, even when I was younger. There's something, you know, truth has a ring to it. Mm-hmm. And for me, the truth just wasn't sitting well, that people have only been around for a few thousand years. I think, only 150 years ago, the Catholic Church was insisting that humans have only existed for 6,000 years, mm-hmm. which made fossils a bit inconvenient. Mm-hmm. So I was always a bit uncomfortable with the way the things were told to me. And I spent a lot of time just doodling around. And then I had a chance when I was getting laid off from different organizations to actually go back and read my books. And I just got more passionate about it. And I thought, what if I can actually make a living doing this? Because this is where my heart really is. I want to find out a different version of events. And that's what got me going. So, five and a half books later, because I'm halfway to writing the sixth right now, it just doesn't stop. It's an ongoing adventure. Mm. And the more you dig up the facts, the more the truth becomes so much different from what we've been told, and much more exciting as well.
And so what was one of the first sacred sites that you remember visiting? Was it as a child, or was it when you were older?
Oh, I lived on one. When I was actually born in Portugal. It's one of the oldest sacred sites in Europe. It's an unusual mountain outside of Lisbon, and it's called Sintra. It's dedicated to the goddess of the moon. And there have been chthonic cults there since 8,000 BC. In fact, There are these local folklores that talk about the mountain and the areas around the coast there being the repository of a people called the people of the serpents, which you find in Indonesia, in Yucatan, in the Middle East, and they were supposed to be involved with a sunken continent called Mu, which, as Edgar Cayce fans will know, was somewhere in the middle of the Pacific, a counterpart to Atitlan, which was, of course, in the ocean that got its name. So this was a group of people that set up shop in this particular part of the world, and that's where I was born. I didn't really know much about it when I was younger, but it's kind of interesting to find out that this is obviously a precursor to what I was going to be doing. But the first one I really visited as a conscious adult, and I use the word loosely, was actually Stonehenge. It was I was living in London at the time, and you have to understand that on a Friday in the summer in London, unless you're certifiable, you don't get into a car and leave town because there are 8 million people trying to do the same thing. And I felt compelled on this day, and I remember calling my then wife, and I said, I really feel the need to go to Stonehenge today. And now she's an American, and even she said, you know, are you mad? I mean, it's Friday, it's summer, you don't do that. I thought, yeah, I know, but I just feel compelled. And we did, and you know, we sat in traffic, and we eventually got to Stonehenge on a Friday. And I got there, and there was like a million people there. There were stages, there was people playing rock music, there was police everywhere, you know, and I just rolled down the window, back in the days when you had to roll down windows. You know, less to go wrong. And I just stuck my head out of the car, and I said to the policeman, I said, you know, what's going on here? And he said, oh, something called harmonic convergence, mate. I don't think you can find a parking space, and we couldn't. So I ended up parking at Avebury, the world's biggest stone circle. And that's where I really sort of got that hit that there's something very special about them. It's not just the stones, there's something special. And that's kind of what led me to, you know, ask more questions about it. And it turns out that so many other people that I've encountered on this path have had exactly the same experience on that particular day in 1987. Which is the harmonic convergence. So it's funny how these things have a way of waking people up. And I do believe it's part of a plan that's set up even before birth to sort of you know, awaken the sleepers within the audience and get them to go and do what they were born to do.
Oh, fascinating. Now, did you, like growing up, were your parents at all interested in archaeology, or was that just something? No.
They are the great unawoken. What the Hindus call the dead, as opposed to the living.
I see.
Or the real.
So how did they take to you going your path? Did they want you to be something else? A banker or something?
We don't really speak to each other very much these days, so that can answer that question. No, I don't think they really understood it. They're from a different era, from a different mentality that really was hoping to, you know, that their children would grow up to be better than they were. They want to be a doctor or an architect or a banker, God help me, you know, despite the fact I'm not that good with numbers. And I think they're still scratching their heads to this day. So, but my grandparents, now they were very unusual. I think that I got my passion from them because my grandmother was incredibly intuitive, and I've discovered that about myself now. I didn't know what it was. I just could see through events and through people. I thought that that was something that was just, you know, some unusual anomaly that I had, but it turns out that it's it runs through the DNA. And it's helped me actually to also observe energy. The more I work with sacred sites, not just on a scholarly level, but on a practical level, the more I can actually observe energy at the sites. And I was told this years ago, and I thought back then these people were mad. And now I can actually see energy lines as well. So it's funny. I mean, we all have this ability. It's just that, you know, the more you do it, the more you develop it, like driving a car, the better you can at it. And then it becomes second nature. So it's all about sort of awakening that latent power that we're all born with. It's a wonderful thing to know.
Now, has Edgar Cayce's information, reading about ancient civilizations, has that been helpful to you, or? In, or most of your research been on your own?
Actually, funny enough, I actually got approached it backwards. I didn't really get into Edgar Cayce. I mean, I knew of him. I knew about his abilities, and they're admirable. But I always felt compelled to follow my own path and then look for the validation. And that way, no one can accuse me of saying, well, he's obviously following this particular line.
Yeah.
It's kind of like being asked to join the Freemasons, which I get asked every year. And I keep saying, well, not, you know, it's a wonderful compliment. But at the same time, you know, if people think that I'm coming at this from my research from a certain point of view, they may think I'm clouding it and I'm using the information to fulfill a certain point of view, which I'm not. And it's, I actually find that approach much more helpful, to sort of follow my own path as much as I can, almost walking into it blindly, which I like to do.
You're unbiased.
And then you go, who else has done this? Let's have a look at Edgar's work. And then you file through the card index and you go, actually, he talked about that as well. Isn't that interesting? And it kind of helps validate his work as well in that way. And I think it's nice, and I've had this also conversation with people like Graham Hancock as well, where I've been working on a project and he would have published it years before, and I suddenly came across it. And we actually spoke at Virginia Beach one day, and I said, you know, I don't want to be accused of plagiarizing your work. It's just, I have no idea you've done this, but I approached it from a totally different point of view. And he said, no, it's fine, because it actually validates both of our work, that we approached it from 180 degrees opposite. We reached the same conclusion. It actually validates each other's work. And besides, we're borrowing from the same cauldron anyway, of information. So it actually helps. So it's kind of funny how the universe works.
Now, how do you alluded to this just a little bit earlier, but how do you see that sacred sites are useful today? Like how can folks, I mean, I know you lead tours, but how do folks interact with those energies, and what helpful purposes do they serve?
Oh, they're useful now as they've ever been. In fact, more so today than ever before. You know, back in the day, and I'm researching at the moment the prehistoric culture that was here on Earth before a horrible flood literally wiped everything clean. Have left of the echoes of the civilization. And back then, it seems to me, from the accounts that I've heard from all across the world from indigenous people, that they actually had the ability to communicate telepathically. They could move at will. They could see far at a distance. They didn't really need the energy. They already were the energy. They were so connected to the land and the cosmos that for them, it was second nature. Any indigenous culture today would understand this. And we've sort of slowly lost that over time, for whatever reason. I think we're here to learn and experience a certain paradigm. And sometimes losing something is the only way to learn the importance of what you had before you lost it. So they began to build sacred sites pretty much later on in later years. We have some examples that go back to about 10,500 BC, but really the true sacred sites in earnest began to be built way after the flood. Like they were trying to reconstruct a network of what I call self-help centers. Because now that we have science that is actually able to look at the energy and measure the energy of the sites, it is true that the sites are where they are to harness an energy that's already there. And it keeps it there and it keeps replenishing it. And anyone that interacts with a sacred site acts like a bit of blotting paper. They take in a little bit of that energy into themselves. And I see this in my tours all the time. People show up and you know, they're very headstrong. They're all into information. By the end of the week, I don't have to tell them anything. They already are perceiving it. And I think that's why they're so important now, because we've lost that ability. There isn't an app on your iPhone that can do this. You know, and yet all you have to do is look outside and watch a hurricane coming through New Jersey and watch everybody sitting there tapping their phone. There's no cell phone signal. And where do I buy a loaf of bread? I mean, this is why these things were built, to get you to connect with that, you know, that bigger portion of yourself that is intuitive. Like I was discussing earlier, that I can do this now as a matter of fact. It helps you sort of come out of your own physicality and appreciate the world, the subtle world around you, so you can work with it better. It doesn't mean that you're going to overcome catastrophes. It means that you are better prepared. You have the tools to prepare and to overcome if necessary. So that's why I think they're much more necessary than they are today. In fact, I just put together a new DVD called Portals, which talks exactly about the science of this mechanism. And one of the most fascinating things about the research was that in about 2008, NASA actually picked up on this information. Whether deliberately or by accident, I don't know. They won't return my emails on the subject. But they were saying that, you know, every 8 minutes, the Earth is opens up. There are these tubes. They call them portals, by the way. These magnetic portals link the Earth to the sun, and they open fairly regularly during the day. And the same phrase written in a different language is said in about 15,000 BC in southern India. And they talk about the serpents that slide along the ground that also connect to the heavens, which are the arrows of sorcerers. A sorcerer being a person that connects with the source. Mm. So these arrows, these energy points called the serpent lines, connect with the hot spots of energy where all the sacred sites are built. So NASA ends up inevitably validating the fact that the ancestors could sense this energy, and wherever they found these tubes of magnetic energy, they would construct the sacred site so that if you felt out of connection, you'd step into these sites and you go, oh, okay, I'm actually connected to a very big picture called the cosmos, and now I get the big picture, and you do your meditation, and you leave, and you go, right, I think there's a big storm coming in about a year, we need to prepare. And that's how they did it. So that's why the sacred sites are very, very important. It helps us to reestablish that connection that we have lost over the last 3,000 years.
Now, do those portals move over time? Like, do they stay connected to the sacred sites? Are there some that are...
Well, from the NASA point of view, I can't get them to validate that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They're probably keeping their cards close to their chest. Mm. Maybe they're being very conservative. But certainly from the research that we've found on the ground, that yes, the reason why the stones are there, and you got to remember, some of these stones were sometimes dragged from 400 miles away. Now, you can't convince me for a second that you've done that to create a calendar, because you and I can sit with a bunch of sticks and create a calendar to look at the motions of the stars by putting the sticks on your front lawn. Mm-hmm. You don't need, 1,500 ton rocks moved from 400 miles away to do that. Mm-hmm. So it tells me that they were there for a reason. And having done a bit of research on the type of stone used for sacred sites, it turns out that yes, they were searching for a specific type of quartz, and the stones are heavily laden with magnetite. Mm-hmm. And together, they actually can be programmed like a modern computer, and now knowing what we know with the power of human intent, which is essentially a packet of electromagnetic information, when you send that intent and you direct it at something, if that material is of a receiving nature, mm-hmm. such as quartz, then that impregnates that material with that intent. And that's how they used to do it in the old days. And I believe that Edgar talks about this in one of his readings as well, the power of thought to create the sacred sites. So this is what's so important about these places, about the stones actually are told to make sure that the energy lines, the serpent lines, are anchored to that spot, and they will never ever move, unless you get a huge bunch of people to go there and do it, which you shouldn't do anyway. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in Egypt, they actually mentioned this quite a lot. There's one wall at the Temple of Edfu where it actually talks about the description of how to build a temple. Mm-hmm. And it shows quite clearly that during the process, there are certain enemy snakes, they call them. These are energy lines that have become distorted or polluted over time. They have to basically remove the serpents, which have become poisoned, and then they actually bring in the new serpents and they anchor them to the ground. So the information is right there.
So these energies can be shifted. So less helpful energies can be moved out and more helpful energies channeled in.
Now,
are there any sacred, of all the sacred sites you've been to, are there any that particularly resonate with you? Like, now you're going on a tour. Do you pick the ones that you feel are particularly active at this time?
No, I pick the ones that are most convenient and have the few amount of tourists going there, which is very difficult today. Planning a tour is an art form in itself, and especially in England, it's very hard to find any free time at some of the sites, but somehow we manage it. I tend to sort of use a plethora of sites to give an impression of how they all behave in different ways. So we might be going to a Gothic cathedral, or a stone circle, or a standing stone, or a sacred well, and each one of them has their own particular type of energy. The trick is not to get fooled by the eye, because you go there and you take photographs and you think, well, this is more impressive than the other one. I said, well, why? Well, because it's bigger, it's more complete. Well, yeah, but that's the exterior. That's the impression that you're getting on an exterior level. That's just decoration. What about feeling? And he said, well, this one's much more potent than the other. I said, well, that's true, because this one has been less adulterated by human interaction. we're in the middle of nowhere here. Fewer people come here, and people do come here, they maintain the integrity of the site so that the next people that come along, they can actually pick up where the others left off, and the process repeats ad nauseum. Mm. So, and that's how I do it. It's going to places that show you different forms of temples that, you know, are doing exactly the same thing. And again, how not to be deceived by your eye, but kind of follow that gut feeling that says, oh yeah, there's something very important here. And from there, you begin to differentiate, is it a masculine energy? Is it a feminine energy? Is it a combination of both? Is the energy positive, or has it become adulterated? And the more you get into it, the more you realize that you can actually do this without thinking about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and so there are times when people get near the site, they don't, you know, they don't feel good. And I'm thinking, well, if you're getting this sort of kick in your gut when you're approaching a place, it's usually a sign that the spirit of place, and there is a spirit of place to these places, and they have a vicious sense of humor to go with it. They're telling you, you know, okay, this is energy, but it's not for you. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you are your own individual radio station. We have a song that's playing right now that some people are going to like, but you're not. Mm-hmm. Your body's going to react to it in a not very positive way. So why don't you go to the next site, do a bit of work, and come back a few years later when you're ready. And I learned this, you know, literally by on a personal level when I used to go to England to certain places that I was drawn to. And I would get there, and I would actually hear this loud voice in the middle of a field. And you got to understand, there's no one living anywhere near. Just literally telling me, just, you know, don't come in here. And I'm looking around for a really annoyed farmer, and there's nobody around. And I'd sort of take that as a no. And I'd go a few miles away, and I'd have dinner with a good friend of mine who's an extraordinary psychic. And I didn't say anything to her. And she said, have you just been down to the Devil's Den? I said, yeah, how'd you know? Did you get a loud voice saying that you shouldn't come in here? I said, how the hell did you know this? I haven't told you. I said, well, it's because the energy is very, very raw at the site. You still don't know enough about this type of energy. You really need to build up your understanding and your resistivity within your body so that when you do go in, it doesn't burn out all your electrical circuits. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely true. And sure enough, 4 years later, after I kind of knew a bit more than I thought I did, I would go back to the Devil's Den. And sure enough, it was like this opening. It's like this carpet, red carpet that gets put out. And I felt like being welcomed there because suddenly my body could now assimilate the energy frequency that was already there. And that's how you raise your frequency a little bit better. Mm-hmm. It's the same with Peru. I mean, I've always wanted to go to Peru. The sites are extraordinary. I get more work done in 1 week in Peru than I can in a whole year because the sites are so strong. They're powerful. They're raw. But you know what? It took me until I was about 50 to finally get there. And now I know why, because I would have been blown out. My circuits would have been totally overloaded. And now I lead the tour every other year. And I basically, you can see me when people film me at these sites, I'm having a really hard time trying to talk to people. Mm. And it's not because of the altitude. Mm-hmm. It's because I can actually hear someone talking to me in my left ear about what the site actually is. Mm. I have to take mental notes while I'm talking. But it sounds like I'm a complete blubbering idiot. And then I tell people to go and experience by themselves. You know, you've got to have personal time. And I sit there scribbling like a lunatic and then do a month's worth of research because you've got to do the scholarly background to it. And sure enough, the information that I got is there. Mm. And I can actually now prove it with actual hard facts. So, and that's how it works. It's absolute magic. And the more you do it, the more you develop this wonderful relationship to it. It becomes like a, you know, having Thanksgiving with a family every week that you want to hang out with all the time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, have you found sacred sites that aren't well known? Have you just happened upon places that you've been called to or just resonate with you?
Oh, absolutely. Wales is usually a pretty good place to go. I've been trying to sort of, I need to get back there a bit more. One of the good things about the British Isles is that we have this wonderful thing called Ordnance Survey maps. They're some of the most beautiful and detailed maps ever published. They even have people's outhouses on them. I mean, they're that accurate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you have time, as you do in England, you get in the car and you drive in the middle of nowhere, you take the map and you go, I wonder what's here. And there's a lot of public access to the land there. There's 65 million people, but there's also as many public footpaths as there are roads. So you can actually cross people's fields where there's a line marked on the map. Mm-hmm. And that takes you to a whole other realm. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful way to actually find things which have been hidden from people for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I do remember going to Wales in remote places where the stones from Stonehenge came from, and going a bit off the beaten track and going down these paths, which clearly have not been used for a long, long time. And suddenly there's a massive standing stone in the middle of nowhere on a hill. And you can tell just by watching it that it wants to talk to you. It's almost like a person. They all have personality. Mm-hmm. And I was there with a friend of mine, and I said, you know what, Kenneth, this stone, it feels like it has a lot of gossip. It wants to talk to someone. And I foolishly sort of put my hand out and touched it, which is something that you shouldn't really do if you know that the stone hasn't been grounded for a while, because these things are, again, they're like batteries. They soak up energy. They haven't been grounded. There are dowsers that will tell you that they get such a belt of shock, electric shock, that you lose the sensation in your forearm for 20 minutes. I mean, it's that strong. Some people have been sent airborne when they douse. And I foolishly just went, it feels like it wants to tell me something. I put my hand out. It's like a hand came out of the stone, grabbed me, and said, oh, finally, bang. And I'm sitting there, and I'm literally just, I can see like a film that's being fast-forwarded so far. And next thing I know, I'm being pulled away from the stone. And my friend of mine said to me later, said, you look like you just downloaded like a library of film. I said, you have no idea what I've just seen. And I was completely out of it for about 24 hours. I was completely drained. It's like sticking your head in the microwave oven. After that, I sat down, and he said, well, what happened? I said, well, I couldn't shut up for hours. I could literally see events that were taking place for hundreds, if not thousands of years. The stone remembered everything that happened around it. Mm-hmm. There were births, marriages, deaths, assassinations, marriages, things that men and women do together that we should talk about on air. It remembered everything that happened in its vicinity, because it is. It's a battery. It's charged. It's a magnetic strip, kind of like cassette tape in the old days. Any of you who are under 30 years of age will have to Google cassette tapes. But it literally, it records everything. Mm-hmm. And until it gets discharged, the first person that comes along picks up the information. So again, not only are they useful for marking energy, they're useful for recording events, which the Aboriginal people in Australia know very well. Mm-hmm. But they're also, that's why they're also used for healing as well, because that energy also heals the body. Mm. So again, these are multiple use places, which, you know, really do come in very useful.
As you're talking, you're helping me integrate an experience that I had, because I lead tours for ARE to sacred sites in different types of locations. And I remember when we were in a tour in Mexico, we were looking for some of these firestones that Edgar Cayce had talked about. And I'm pretty energetically thick. Like I'm not a highly sensitive person that way. And so I remember we found, you know, off the path, we found something, that three round stones. And, you know, there were lots of them, but somehow these seemed interesting. And so we did a ceremony there, and I felt an energy there. And it's hard to describe, but I felt that something shifted in me in that ceremony. And I remember for the rest of the day, I was sucked dry. Like I didn't have, and the assistant guide, who was like a shaman, he saw what was going on. And so he protected me the rest of the day, making sure people didn't interfere too much. But that, I saw pictures of myself before that experience and after, and it really looked like there had been an energetic shift in me in a positive way.
I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah, you should drink a lot of water and eat a lot of meat when you do that kind of work. Because what's happening is you're basically talking with another electromagnetic being, and we are an electromagnetic being. Mm-hmm. So it's just that their frequency is like four radio stations above ours. Yeah. So to get from here to here, it requires a lot of expenditure of energy on our behalf. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like I said, it's like sticking your head in the microwave oven. You've got to ground yourself. And the way I do it best And I mean, this is not a joke. I literally do eat a lot of meat after I've worked with sacred sites and energy, especially if I've moved energy around. Yeah. And I drink a lot of wheat beer. Uh-huh. Something about the wheat, fermented wheat, really helped to ground me.
Yeah.
It puts back into my system what I need. Well, but that's just my technique. Other people just drink water.
I like very, that. Any reason to eat meat and drink beer sounds good to me.
We call it research.
Yeah.
Yes. And sometimes that's serious research.
No, I have another. I have another question. That I've gone to Egypt with John Van Auken several times. I think about 10 times. And then, you know, the Arab Spring happened, and then there was we stopped going. And then we kind of went one time after, you know, after the revolution. And I remember these sites were empty. You know, in Giza, yeah, where there used to be 400 buses, we were the only bus. And it felt so different to be in these sites. With this, because, you know, in the heyday, you know, 20 different guides, 20 languages, you can barely see anything. You're moving like this with all the people. And do you think that there's any, like these sites, let's say, like, you know, the pyramids and all the Egyptian sites, do you think they needed a cleanse? That in some ways, that with the decrease in tourism, is that anything part of that? You know, is there a metaphysical purpose for that, do you think?
Oh, there is a metaphysical purpose behind everything. There's a bigger picture.
Yeah.
It's wheels with wheels. I mean, the more you look away from it without emotion, the better you get at understanding how these cycles work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like people complain about the wrong president being in power. I said, yeah, but it fulfills a purpose.
Yes.
There's a purpose to all of this. And sometimes bad things have to happen to people to wake up. Mm-hmm. It's just the way human nature works. We either do it voluntarily or involuntarily. Part of the process is that, I mean, the sites are self-regulating. They are so well protected. Mm-hmm. And the local people will tell you that, you know, sometimes they're afraid of the pyramids because they do see a lot of, you know, balls of light or mm-hmm. orbs, as they call them, mm-hmm. Floating around the pyramids, like many sacred sites. And mm-hmm. I've filmed them. I've seen them myself. Mm-hmm. You can communicate with them. And sometimes it's just pure energy mm-hmm. Built up by the nature of the place. But mm-hmm. there's also the way that a lot of spirit forms from another level of reality manifest in our own level of reality, because they can't physicalize. They're too far up the scale to come down to our frequency. The closest that they can interact with us is on the light spectrum. So you'll see these orbs flying around the place, and they literally are protective spirits. They know that people go there just to take pictures and to show, you know, mm-hmm. Light interest in something that's quite important, really. Mm-hmm. And so they do self-regulate. There is a certain protective element about them. And you find the same thing at Stonehenge as well, which is, you know, it's even worse. You can't even go anywhere near the stones.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can, you have to pay a fortune mm-hmm. to be there with people who go there to be tourists, which mm-hmm. doesn't really help.
Mm-hmm.
And you go there, and it's really disappointing. Mm-hmm. The site is just a bunch of rocks sitting around, smoking a cigar, having a drink. But when you get it to yourself, and I've, you know, back in the days before English Heritage took over the site, and in my opinion, ruined it, I used to hang out with the guards in the middle of the night and used to pay £10. They used to leave you alone for a whole hour,
mm.
sometimes 2 hours, if mm. they recognized you were there to meditate. They were very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And the site opens up into something very, very different because mm. it reacts to you. It knows that you're there to respect, and you go there with a preconceived notion of, I would like to know something about A, B, C, or D. How does this fit into my understanding? What can I learn from this? And what can I bring here to add to the energy of the site? And when you do that, it behaves like an organism. It mm-hmm. reacts in kind. It gives you information. You give a little bit of it back. So the pyramids act in the very same way. They self-regulate. They self-protect.
Mm-hmm.
And also, don't forget that there are people going around in small groups who also pretend to be tourists, but we go to these places to cleanse the place up.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually work with one such group where we do go around doing what we call spiritual terrorism,
mm-hmm.
Where we actually undo the things that silly tourists do mm. to sacred sites.
Mm-hmm.
This is one reason why we can't go inside the Great Pyramids of the Yucatan, because people use them as urinals, for God's sake. It's really quite silly. Yeah. And then, you know, one person does something silly because they can't be bothered to go to the toilet, you know, where it should be. And then suddenly they close the whole place down. Well, people like us can come along, we have to cleanse the place, pretend that we're doing tourism, but quietly do the work that we do, and we reset it. So there's a lot of people working behind the scenes, doing what we enjoy doing, which is basically cleansing, taking out the trash, mm-hmm. putting it in the receptacle where it should be, and that's how it's always been. There's always going to be people that do this for the right reason and for the wrong reasons. And there's also people who do things behind, you know, behind the curtain, that don't draw attention to themselves, particularly so that they can keep doing the cleansing of the site. So I wouldn't worry too much about them. They're being looked after in their own particular way. But I agree, now's a great time to go, because I find that whenever something horrible happens down there, the place empties. You get the place to yourself. And there is nothing better than having a photograph of an Egyptian temple without people in front of it. It's so rare.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you, for when you lead groups and yourself personally, do you advise people to develop some kind of a meditation practice or some kind of attunement practice so that they can interact more deeply with the energies that they're going to be experiencing at the sacred sites?
Oh, I just tell them to be themselves and just to basically do two things. One, you know, you've obviously come to hear what I have to say,
right.
But at the same time, for me to spend the whole day talking, you're going to end up back at home with my voice in your head, and that's not very good.
Yeah.
It might be, but I wouldn't find it very funny. Mm. I would say, okay, well, if you want to hang out with me, I will talk about A, B, C, and D, about the things that are important to bring out, and then I'm going to give you 2 hours, 3 hours on your own, which surprises the hell out of people. And I think because you have to understand, this is a personal journey. It's not, otherwise you're doing my journey, and I'm doing this for totally different reasons. I'm doing this because I want to teach. Mm-hmm. I want to learn and teach and hopefully get the information right. You're here to develop something within you. I want you now to get out of your head and just walk around aimlessly and remember what brought you here. What was the reason why you wanted to come here? There had to be an intent, an underlying reason that draw you to this particular site. Remember that, because once you put that in your mind, the temple is going to react to that. And by the end of the trip, if you just cleanse and keep an open mind, expect nothing, because when you go to these places and you expect things to happen, they won't. Mm. If you just go in and walk quietly and do it, you know, do it honestly, you'd be amazed how much magic actually happens. Mm. That's how I usually do it. That's how I, you know, tell people to behave. It's just, you know, whatever works for you in whatever manner. Mm-hmm. You can sit there cross-legged, you can hum, you can tone. And sometimes we do group work together, mm-hmm. if the appropriate place comes about. Very difficult to do in Egypt because of the politics.
Yes.
You're not allowed to do any meditation now.
Yes.
So you kind of have to do it a little bit on the side and project to the side, which is another way of doing it. Very naughty, but, you know, it works. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just let people sort of clear their heads, forget about any preconceived notions, and just approach the site as if it's a member of your family and say, what have I come here to learn?
Mm-hmm.
And just leave it, because you might not get it at the Great Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
You might get it 8 days later at, say, a tefillah, you know, or a komombu, which most people don't even sort of seem to care much about, mm-hmm. but it's a really potent site.
Mm-hmm.
But that might not be appropriate for someone who's searching for something else.
Mm-hmm.
They'll get theirs at Edfu, and that's how it works. It's whatever's appropriate for what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that the more you approach it on a personal level and just allow yourself to assimilate with a site without expectation, it's amazing what you're going to get back.
Mm. Well, that's good to hear, because I think, you know, I still lead a tour a year for the ARE, and I try to approach it in a similar sort of way. Now, have you ever been to Angkor Wat? I'm going to be going in November. And I've always been.
Oh, take you with it.
Yeah, I've always been very curious about that site.
It's on my hit list. The reason why I haven't been there is because A, it's perpetually hot, humid, and it's full of snakes, and you have to have lots of injections. These are all the things I hate in life. I can't stand snakes, and worst of all, I'm afraid of needles. I have a phobia of needles.
Well, I'm a hypnotherapist, so, you know, I'll give you my card, and we can work together.
Oh, good. I hear that there's a fake website where you can get fake forms, and I don't know. I should be mentioning this on air, but there's a way around it, and I am going to get there before they wreck it, because unfortunately the amount of tourism is drawing so much water from the water table that the whole place is sinking. However, the best places to go, not that Angkor Thom, for example, which is my favorite, is important, because it is, and it's much older than we've been led to believe. It's actually built on the foundation of something much, much older. In fact, the name Angkor means the glory of Horus, which is an Egyptian name. Now, what's an Egyptian god doing in the middle of Cambodia? There's your answer. If you go further inland to the sites that they're now discovering, those are less visited because most people don't sort of do the homework. But they're discovering that the site is actually at least three times bigger than they thought. So just, you know, grab a bus or a bicycle and go to the less visited places where you get a bit of personal time, connect with the place. It is a lot older than I thought, and there's a lot of magic there. So, I envy you.
Oh, thank you. Well, there's room on the tour, so join us.
If you want someone to carry your suitcase, let me know.
Sounds really good. So when are you coming back to the ARE? When are you coming to Virginia Beach?
Oh, they drag me kicking and screaming and beg me to come back. It's going to be this, is it September? Yes, it is. Or is it October?
Oh, for the Ancient Mysteries. Yeah. Oh, good, good. So you're coming soon.
It's about September, October, somewhere around there. So, yeah, I'm going to be coming up with some new material on ancient civilizations, ancient architects, and hopefully some new evidence on the time around the flood. Which links it very much to the Edgar Cayce material, but expands on it.
Is that what your new book is about? The one you're working on now?
Yeah, I'm fine, basically. I hope it's not going to be like Fingerprints of the Gods 2, God help us. You know, that's been done. I want to see it from a different point of view. I'm trying, you see, the more I ask people from around the world, who are indigenous people, because so much of our history is literally, it's bookended by Europeans, Anglo-Saxon European academics who think they know everything and they know better than the people about which they're writing. I think that's completely wrong and arrogant, because the more I go to the Yucatan or Peru or Egypt and I talk to the local people and the local historians and people who really have no grind, no axe to grind with any particular theory, I find I learn a lot more, and that I find their answers are much more persuasive, because it starts to link the importance of myth to fact. Because in the West, we tend to apply myth as being an over imagination. But how do you explain if these myths talk about events that are over 15,000 years old, and if the people that came up with the myths were supposed to be loincloth wearing Neanderthals who dragged women by the hair into their caves, how would these, you know, supposedly unintelligent people capable of coming up with some of the most extraordinary stories, beautiful details about flying ships, and lost lands and people that could move through the air? The two do not connect. And the more I begin to look at the stories from a local point of view, from an indigenous point of view, the more the information gets interesting. So that's what I'm trying to do. I want to write this book from a point of view of people who are closer to the event of the Great Flood 11,000 years ago. And how do they relate to what they call the gods? Where did the gods come from? Because they weren't connecting with Neanderthals. They appear to have been keeping themselves to themselves. They seem to have come across the water out of desperation when their landmass collapsed under the ocean. So they were forced to communicate with ordinary humans. So my answer is, where did they come from? Where were their lands? What did they look like? And what did they want with us? And why did they keep themselves to themselves until the last possible minute? So those are things that haven't really been quite addressed in my point of view, but they also haven't been addressed from the indigenous point of view. And there are some very interesting stories, but here's the best part. They all connect. They all describe the same events. They all describe their people in the same way. And that's what I find compelling, because apparently these people were never supposed to have contacted each other. Because remember, 11,000 years ago, we didn't have the wheel, we didn't have many boats. Actually, they got around much more than we give them credit for. I've just come across stuff from New Zealand, and not from the Maori. There was already another people in New Zealand long before the Maori. I've just been reading their oral history, which has just been translated and published. And my God, they actually describe being on the ocean during the flood. And thank God, because they would have been killed otherwise, because they're talking about huge waves. If they'd been anywhere near a coastline, they wouldn't have survived. But they survived to tell the tale. And one of the things I find fascinating, and it's one of the reasons why I kept being drawn to New Zealand every other year, is that they were going to find a place called the birthplace of the gods. And I've been there three times now. And I tell you, it's a sacred site. It's a natural landscape temple. It is beyond words. I really do struggle to come up with adjectives when I go to this place, because if you didn't think that you were psychic, Peter, you would be when you go to this place. It's like you can hear and see things in front of your eyes.
Where is this again? It's
in the South Island of New Zealand. It's a place called Kura Tauhiti, which I'll be talking about at the conference. And it's basically called Castle Hill in English. But they called it the birthplace of the gods. And there's a huge mystery there that I feel that we've only begun to scratch the surface. And I remember the Dalai Lama going there, and he felt the same way. He said, there's something very, very important about this site, and it connects somehow to Tibet. I'm not sure, but the Hopi were saying the same thing as well. So there's a big triangle of mystery going on here, and I can't wait to go back.
Well, it sounds, in my travels, I've also, you hear all these different cultures talking about the flood experience. And so it seems it's a really valuable to collect all these stories. So it sounds like a great addition to the metaphysical literature. So looking forward to that.
If you can survive chapter one, which is basically a description of the flood from about 100 different points of view from the people who were actually there, it makes for some fascinating and yet calamitous reading. I mean, you finish reading this. I just finished editing it. And I thought, I'm actually sweating reading this because the accounts are all the same with slight variations because, of course, the waves were different depending on where you are on the earth. But they pretty much had the same angle on the actual event. And when you're actually there watching it from their experience, it's hair-raising. It really is. But obviously someone survived to tell the tale. But yeah, there's nothing like talking to the people that were actually closer to the event, unlike us, who are around today. I mean, what do we know? We're just scratching the surface, digging in the rubbish bin of history, trying to find out what was going on. They knew much more than we did, and that's what makes it fun.
Well, Fred, our time has come to almost to a close. I've really enjoyed chatting with you. If you can make it to Cambodia, I'll cover your steak and beer tab, no problems.
Oh, it might be cheaper just to get my airfare if you're going to cover my beer tab.
That's right.
we got to get down there at some point.
Yeah, I hope so. We'll be in touch, and hopefully I can see you when you're here next.
Absolutely, yeah. I'll see you down there at the conference.
Yeah, thanks for your time. Have a good rest of your day.